Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Yes. Anyway, so I'll let you guide the conversation.
Okay.
Yep.
I will do my best. Okay. Did you want to talk a little bit about the weird email to begin with, whether or not we would include it in the podcast? But it seemed like it was fresh on your mind.
Yeah, it's okay. I guess there's probably no point really, but I thought it was you know, pretty nasty attack, I guess, that particular email.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if you'd received an email like that, I you wouldn't have been very happy, right?
No, I would have definitely been annoyed by it. But I would have been hesitant about calling it an attack, I guess, because it could be somebody who just had communication difficulties and didn't really realize that they were being so unconstructive, possibly. I'm just saying, I mean, it was best to give the benefit of the doubt. I guess you didn't respond to him, though.
I did, yeah. I just sort of wanted a bit of clarification and... Then he actually just emailed me this morning, kind of, he was slightly less condescending this time, but, I don't know, I guess the guy considers himself some kind of expert on writing and grammar and all that kind of thing. I don't know if he's a former English teacher or something. Apparently an English teacher. I don't know, but anyway, yeah, anyway, it doesn't really matter. I just thought you'd be, I just wanted a bit of feedback, that's all.
Yeah, I understand, like a reality check.
Yeah, no, that's all. But yeah, I've kind of, you know, put writing on hold at the moment anyway. So it's funny, actually, the timing, because I, you know, because a while back, I wrote that novel, right?
Well, I knew you were working on it. I wasn't where you'd finished it.
Oh, okay, yeah, anyway, so I finished that novel.
It's
just, you know, 50,000 words. It was pretty short, but it was it's kind of like a young adult novel and science fiction. And so I sent that off to, you know, various agents and so on, and I didn't, you know, well, it never got published, of course. I don't think it ever will get published, but... you know, I've heard...
Why is that? I mean, because of the initial response, or because of how you feel about it?
Oh, I guess just, yeah, just because of the response, and, you know, I guess, realistically speaking, you know, no one gets their first novel published. That seems to be the case. I've, you know, heard of all these authors, you know, they write, you know, say, 5 or 6 practice novels, and then eventually they get something published. And I also spoke to John Michael Greer. He was on your show stage, and he said something interesting. He said that years ago he tried to break into writing science fiction, and he didn't have any success. And then the first non-fiction book proposal that he put together, it was actually accepted. So, you know, and that's so he went down that path. Now he's sort of getting into writing fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just really, really competitive.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Did you have any success with your novel? I know you
Novel, I finished it. I thought I'd finished it some months back, and I sent it to Gary Height. And he rightly told me he didn't think it was finished and that it needed this, that, and the other. So he gave me some good constructive feedback, and then
Yeah.
I didn't go back for a couple of months, and then I did, and or rather, no, that's not true. I followed his suggestions and took a lot of stuff out, reworked it, and then I rewrote some new material, and then I left it, and then I went back to it just
Yeah.
recently after a couple of months, and I found that it seemed to be certainly a lot better, but even like it was ready. So I just sent it to him again.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know about that, but it's interesting because what you're saying about science fiction, well, about fiction in general, but specifically we both chose science fiction genre, that my wife is just reading or listening to the audiobook Dune, which I've never read. I've tried like three times, I think, to read it, and I could never get past the first chapter.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
I'm like you. I found I didn't like the, well, I don't know if this was the case with you, but I tried reading it. I just couldn't get into the story, and the style of the writing didn't really appeal to me. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the obstacles I find with sci-fi in general, and this isn't something I attempted in my novel, is the creating a whole world. I mean, my sci-fi isn't in the future, it's not really science fiction. But anyway, they've got to create a whole world and all these characters. In the case of Dune, it's non-human, and so it can be very, very dense and take a long time just to get accustomed to that world. And I don't tend to have the patience as a reader, much less as a writer, for that. But anyway, that was a side thing. What she said about the Dune was, she was describing how even in the first chapter it lays down the kind of mechanics of using trauma to develop psychic abilities and to program the agents, and this is the good guys in the novel, how they create these super agents that have more or less uncrackable programming, and by using trauma to do so. And there's more stuff I don't remember now, but it's quite specific, seemed to have quite a few correlations with MKUltra, etc. And so, of course, I ended up wondering, oh, well, was Frank Herbert, an insider? Did he know about some of this stuff? And of course, Dune was hugely influential book, and so, and this is one of the things I get into part two of Prisoner Infinity, the degree to which science fiction has been used as part of larger social engineering programming, and specific to how it overlaps with NASA's scenario planning. Do you know about that?
You might need to explain that.
Yeah, scenario planning is something that NASA were doing in the 70s. Whether they're still doing it, I don't know. They would get writers to write accounts of the future in the past tense as if it had already happened. So basically, they were writing science fiction, but based around the possible developments, advances in technology that they wanted to bring about. So it was kind of a way to try out certain ideas and see how coherent they could be made. But also, they then branched out into, simultaneously, they were, because they may have been hiring science fiction writers to do this for them, but also then they wanted science fiction writers to write fictional narratives for public consumption that were more or less in line with scenario planning, as a way to introduce these ideas to the population, with various different aims, but one of them being to seed new generations with inspiration, such as has been discussed a little bit about Star Trek, like ideas in Star Trek. Kids grew up on Star Trek, grew up to become engineers, to become scientists, to become this and that and the other, partly inspired by the show. They wanted to actually realize, that the fantasies that had been seeded in them through this science fiction. So I think that's a really large, unexplored, unrecognized area of social engineering, technological development, particularly around technology, space travel and whatnot, that puts science fiction writing into an entirely different context and makes it seem as though it's actually one of the most important areas of in society, let's say, and therefore one of the most carefully controlled.
Yeah. It's interesting you mention all this because I was I just read a biography of L. Ron Hubbard, and he's you know, he was there at the you know, at the beginning of the sort of you know, golden age of science fiction, and he wrote a lot of stories.
Yeah, that's an understatement. I think he's in the Guinness Book of Records, actually, of having written more books than anyone alive.
Yeah, really prolific.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, he could just sit there at a typewriter and just type away very rapidly, just for hours on end. He'd just churn out all, you know, story after story after story. Yeah, so it's just amazing. And I read his novel, what was it called again? Sorry. Battlefield Earth, that really huge novel that he wrote just towards the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't know if you saw the movie, but the
movie's
really bad.
No, I didn't. Yeah, yeah.
John Travolta, he's in it. It's sort of famous for being one of the worst movies of all time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I thought I'd check that out. And oh gosh, I mean, there's some interesting ideas in there. Like it's set in the year 3000, and there's this alien race, the Cyclos. They've taken over humanity, and humanity's reverted to a sort of primitive state.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Cyclos are just like mining the earth, and you know, they're particularly interested in gold. And so the humans, you know, they rise up and battle the Cyclos and try and, you know, win the earth back, kind of thing. You can tell that he, like, because he apparently he wrote this novel in like a month, and it's like 1,000 pages. So
wow.
And I don't know, like, some of the writing's quite good, other I don't know, it's some of it's a bit sloppy, and you can tell it was just kind of stream of consciousness writing, you know. But yeah, I don't know, like, there's some big ideas in it, and it sort of ties back to the sort of ancient astronauts stuff, sort of von Daniken material. And, you know, I think when he wrote that, he was really kind of tapping into the collective psyche sort of thing. And I know that he just had this huge influence on science fiction. And, of course, he even, you know, created his own religion, which is amazing. And so, yeah, that, you know, he's one person who, you know, he was involved in both areas, you know, spirituality, if you want to call it that, and also science fiction. So I recommend that you look deeply into L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, God, that would be my next case study. I don't know, being targeted by you-know-who.
Seriously, it's really... the Russell Miller biography, that's a really fascinating book. I mean, it doesn't tell the whole story, of course, because how could you? But he seems to have been very deeply involved in the intelligence community, and, and I don't know, according to some accounts, he was a really horrible human being, or Ron Hubbard, you know, wife beater and all that kind of thing. And of course, he was interested in Aleister Crowley's, you know, sex magic rituals, and he knew Jack Parsons. You'd know about that whole, you know, his involvement with Jack Parsons and magical rituals that they did and things like that. It's just a fascinating area, but.
Did you read this recently, this biography?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I wrote a couple of little articles about it for Mysterious Universe. Because I don't know, because I did also, I sent you a famous interview, I think think it was in Penthouse magazine that it was published. It was Wiz,
his
son, yeah.
Yeah.
And his son was saying that the purpose of Scientology, you know, it was actually like a form of, you know, social engineering or kind of mind control technology where they would try and, you know, shatter, I think he actually used that specific term, shatter a person's psyche and try and sort of open a doorway to this other realm kind of thing and letting in energies. I know it sounds very esoteric, but the way you described it, it sounded quite sort of plausible and compelling. But so he seems to be referring to, you know, basically what you were talking about was, you know, in the case of Whitley Strieber and MK Ultra and that kind of thing. So
yeah. Well, the parallels between Hubbard and Strieber are really legion, I think. And starting with just this basic overlap, as you zeroed in on, between fiction writing, science fiction writing, and fantasy writing, and becoming a spiritual teacher and making prophecies and predictions about the future. And, and so then there's, and the thing with NASA is kind of non-esoteric, as I described it. It was just saying, if you see generations with ideas about the future, they will grow up to try and bring those ideas into reality. That's quite non-esoteric. It's quite easy to understand just as very simple psychological terms. But what you're touching on with the fragmentation of the psyche and all of that, or even before getting to that, there's this idea, there's this term, I just heard it recently, and if you've heard it, called hyperstition. You ever heard that term?
No, I haven't.
I think it might have been that guy Nick Land, who's kind of notorious as Nietzschean philosopher. Anyway, I don't know enough about him to describe him, but the hyperstition has to do with this way in which intense belief brings about reality, and not just in the terms of NASA, as in just, you know, causing people to try and make it happen, but in more, in this more subtle esoteric way in which we actually do somehow generate reality through our belief in it. So L. Ron Hubbard, I mean, I'm curious because you've read about him, so you've got much more at your fingertips, because I've just picked it up here and there over the years. But he, whatever he was doing early on, whether this was before he was part of intelligence or after or simultaneous with it, this ability apparently he had, if he really did write all those books, because of course he could have just been fronting for lots of writers. But either way, well, maybe not either way, but if he was writing them himself, it would suggest that he was a channel of some kind, as you said, that he was able to actually tap into the collective unconscious, let's call it that, and come up with all these visionary scenarios, which, of course, is a very handy talent for a science fiction writer. But at a certain point, he decided or was directed to turn that material into the basis for a religion, to actually say, no, this isn't fiction, this is real. Seems as though there's a kind of training that could happen for somebody there. Like, when, I mean, Whitley started as a fiction writer.
Yeah, and he was, his first novels, The Wolf and The Hunger, they're actually really, really good novels. Like, The Hunger's, you know, the writing's just beautiful. It's very poetic, and, you know, I thought it was a great, great novel. And funnily enough, it just, his fiction just sort of went downhill from there, and the stuff that he's been writing recently is, I don't want to be too critical, I know it's, this is his bread and butter now, really, because he just releases novel after novel, like Alien Hunter, one of his most recent ones, where... there's all these continuity issues in that. It looks like it hasn't even been edited. If you go to Amazon, type in Alien Hunter, you'll see all these very critical reviews, because people were saying that, you know, like the characters seem to change age from one. It's very fragmented, the whole novel. And it's funny, too, because it's now the basis for this TV series that's coming out. I think they've already made a few episodes. So Hunters, I think they've called it. So I'm surprised that they would want to turn that into a television show. I mean, I guess it's just because of the whole, you know, it's kind of like it blends detective fiction with, you know, science fiction and the whole alien abduction narrative. And, you know, that's really, it's become popular again because I don't know if you've been following the latest X-Files series.
I did watch it, yeah.
Yeah, and I honestly can't understand why that's so popular because, like, I enjoy the occasional episode, but just it just seems
it's bad. Like, it's really, it's, really bad. Yeah,
yeah. It's just the characters are sort of, you know, like it sort of attempts to be quirky and interesting, but you can tell that the people writing it, you know, it's that they're not really, or they're not passionate about that area, I don't think, and they're not trying to. They're just sort of tapping into the most sort of, you know, sort of the most boring ideas in that area. Like, it's, you know, it's all, you know, like metal flying saucers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, but anyway.
Well, I mean, just to linger momentarily on X-Files, my impression of that was that I expected them to upgrade it because TV's got so much better since the X-Files. I thought we were going to get this new reboot. But they didn't. They actually did the shows as they were in the past, the same level of aesthetic, you know, writing and directing. It was all aesthetically more or less the same level. And that those old episodes are kind of unwatchable now, I think. And this series was pretty much at that level. So I think that they were counting on nostalgia and actually wanting to appeal to nostalgia more than anything with that show. How relevant that is to the larger question that you're bringing up about Hunters. And I mean, of course, TV, you know, if they figure they can make a commercial hit out of it and the idea, you know, the concept is high enough, then that's all they care about. But it does also raise the question of, well, if they're looking for, when I say they, I don't mean the TV corporations, but the hypothetical elements behind them, you know, if intelligence agency, social engineers, what have you, are looking for a particular material that will promote the ideas they want to promote, then that's the main thing, right? And of course, if Whitley's been part of that, as I think is almost, well, for me, it's pretty much unquestionable now. I don't know how you feel about it, but that he's part of this larger memeplex that's actually all about disseminating ideas and themes and concepts. And he seems to be getting legitimized now, on the one hand through Kripal, the world of academia that Kripal represents, and now he's also got his most high-profile mainstream thing since the day after, I guess. But he didn't really get associated with the day after very much, I don't think, whereas his name is all over this Hunter thing. It's like New York Times best-selling author, et cetera. So it's definitely raising his profile.
Yeah.
And so I haven't read the books, and I don't plan to watch the show, although I might have to watch one just as a researcher. I imagine there's something in... Well, it was terrorism. I watched the trailer. It's all about terrorism, and it's the alien, the terrorist alien. So it's literally demonizing the terrorist, right?
twist and fan, the courage of a catalytic hardened man, for God's grand, it's God's goodbye. Ah, bloody in the garment of a ghost and sad, the condemned to the body doesn't die.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I'm interested to check it out. But yeah, so it is interesting that he's. Well, I think this needs to be acknowledged, the fact that, you know, Whitley would be, what, probably in his 60s now?
He must be 70, I think.
He's 70, right, okay. He's really kind of getting on, and I'm fascinated that his career's only just now sort of, I suppose, blossoming, or he's, as you said, he's being legitimized through, you know, academia, Kripal, you know, with this book Supernatural, and, you know, and Kripal sort of saying that, you know, yeah, comparing him to all these famous sort of religious figures and things like that, and, yeah, he's sort of giving a lot of credibility to Strieber. It's almost as though they kind of realized that people didn't quite buy the alien abduction narrative, and now they've got to sort of take it in a new direction to sort I don't know if you feel the same way about that, but it's almost as though they've taken it to a point where they've realized, yeah, people aren't into this so much, or people have outgrown this.
Yeah.
And now we've got to take it down another path and sort of keep it alive, almost, you know, all that alien abduction stuff, because now Kripal's, yeah, comparing it to, you know, religious visions and, you know, all these other sort of, yeah, spiritual experiences and things like that, you know.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I mean, we say that, well, I said it too, that the world of academia through Kripal is legitimizing Strieber and his experiences, but the book itself, I can't see it really flying in academic circles. I can't see anyone in academia taking it seriously. What do you think?
Well, Kripal is, you know, I guess he's got tenure, I don't know how. You know, he must be respected by his colleagues at the, you know, whichever university he works at. They, you know, other academics must be reading his papers and things like that. He's, yeah, he seems to be respected, and
But the book itself isn't really an academic book.
No, but I can understand that, because, well, I guess, okay, they wanted to bring this book to as wide an audience as possible, and I guess, yeah, the best way to do that was to, I mean, you know, write this kind of book. It needed to be published by, you know, Penguin, and really, you know, I know too that academics do, even if they're not sort of, you know, even if they're not going to go out in public and say, you know, I'm interested in all these esoteric areas, they might be sort of privately interested in those areas, you know, so they might be reading the book but not necessarily telling anyone about it, so.
Well, sure. But, well, a couple of things. One is, I mean, doesn't the world of academia, don't academics generally frown on fellow academics who dumb down the material in order to reach a wider audience? I mean, isn't that kind of anti-academic itself to do that?
Okay, so you'd say that Kripal is, don't want to sound offensive here, but sort of sold out a little bit?
Well, I wouldn't simplify in that way, because, as you know, I think that there's part of a larger agenda and that he's doing his job in some way. I think maybe an element of that he wants popular success and whatnot, and Strieber seems a way to get it.
It's a bit ironic because of Whitley's insistence that he's a totally marginalised, you know. Anyway, so it's not so much that that he seems to be selling out, but that he seems to be, and I don't want to be offensive either, so I better think about, choose my words
how you word it.
Yeah.
I feel I've already probably said too much. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I did enjoy the book, The Supernatural. I mean, I just read it, you know, in a couple of days. I sort of,
yeah.
It's obviously a well-written book, and I suppose the Kripal parts are probably the most interesting, because all the Strieber material, that's already been covered in all these other books, so...
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I did enjoy it.
But you had a strong reservation, because when you read my piece, you seemed...
Yep. Yeah, well, it's just, first of all, I found it sort of difficult to really sort of connect with the book.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that Kripal was maybe, well, some of the experiences that Strieber describes, like, you know, he mentions some of his abduction experiences involving human beings. And Kripal sort of says, well, that was probably, you know, and Strieber sort of suggests that maybe the intelligence community's been involved in some of his abduction experiences. And I think that's very plausible. And of course, also he talks about the implant that he got in his ear as well.
Yeah.
When they tried to remove it, apparently this little object moved away or whatever, and I don't know, maybe it's some sort of advanced technology or something, but then Kripal says that, you know, shamans have similar kinds of experiences, because he kind of describes Strieber as a sort of shaman, and he says that, you know, like, you know, shamans can make objects appear and disappear and, you know, that kind of thing, so... You know, perform all those strange kind of magic tricks, I guess you could call them. But I think I'm kind of losing the thread here.
Well, I think that you've said plenty just by zeroing in on that.
But you would probably say that you know the intelligence community was involved in some of Strieber's abductions, and it would be probably a little bit silly to, you know, compare those experiences to, you know, various religious experiences and shamans and that kind of thing, because that sort of moves it into the realm of spirituality instead of, you know, fact, I suppose. Or
yes, and this is what I was trying to get at, really, is that it seemed to me that Jeffrey Kripal had a very clear agenda in his commentary for that book and in his choice of Whitley Strieber as a subject, which was to spin these experiences in the way that he wanted to spin them, or in the way that somebody wanted them to be spun, and that there was very little academic about that, like an academic inquiry. I mean, Prisoner of Infinity is an academic inquiry into Whitley Strieber compared to The Supernatural, and even just generally, I'd say, with the footnotes and the citations and the different... frames of reference, or, you know, I'm not an academic, needless to say, but I have some sense of what an academic inquiry looks like, and it has to be very thorough, and it has to just look at the evidence and from many different angles and not jump to conclusions, and certainly not impose some interpretation onto the material and then, you know, reshape the material to prop up that interpretation. And that's what, in my opinion, Kripal was doing. So I don't see how he could actually believe himself that was academic, much less convince anyone else.
I mean,
it's really, like you say, zero in on certain examples. It's kind of a howler is the word that's coming to mind. I mean, just something that's just really blatantly off about it. To try and argue that an implant in Strieber's ear is proof that the psychic can materialize is, I mean, that's something you would expect from, I don't know, like Jane Roberts or Shirley MacLaine, or you know, that's New Age kind of writing. Yeah. So there just seems to be something very dishonest about the supernatural. Like it's not, it's claiming to be one thing, whereas it's actually another thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm, as you know, I feel this way about Strieber in general. And yeah, after the years looking at this, at the opus such as it is, it continues growing, finding more and more holes in the plot, things that don't fit in the picture. Like some of those kids, those drawings that we were given as kids, where you've got to find the weird things in there, the anomalies, right? His opus is just full of that stuff. And I just wonder, like, how does he get away with it? Like you were saying about Alien Hunter, has all of these inconsistencies in it that are just bad writing, essentially, just lazy, sloppy writing. Well, you could say that about the whole of Strieber's output, in terms of not just the writing, but in terms of his, the narrative that he's created, that Kripal is now embellishing and endorsing. It's just full of these glaring contradictions, which frankly, as I write in the piece, some of them amount to outright lies. So one of the things that's really fascinating me is how does that happen, you know? How does such a high-profile public figure get away with that?
But the, I don't know. I mean, it sort of seems to be, when you write a book, it's not what you say so much. It's sort of how you say it. And Kripal and Strieber, they're really clever with words. I mean, they're masters of writing. And I think that's how they get away with it. They just... You know, people don't sort of question it so much if they think, oh, okay, this is intelligent writing, therefore the authors must know exactly what they're talking about. You know, because, yeah, if you're really clever with words, you can just get away with anything. You know, people aren't going to question it so much. They're going to assume that you're intelligent and that you're an authority on what you're writing about.
Right. And there's also the context that's created. So we've got the packaging of the supernatural, you know, the high-profile mainstream publisher, the nice hardback edition. You've got the pre-release publicity. This is the most important book on the paranormal since da-da-da-da-da, Book of the Damned. Whatever else has gone into... sort of shoehorning this work into people's psyches, I guess. That it does seem as though, I mean, because for me it creates something of cognitive dissonance that, I mean, it's weird, Lewis, because when I first wrote the piece on it, and same with Prisoner Infinity in general, which of course that's much longer, it's been going on for 2 years or more, 3 years now, the prevailing feeling I was having was, what if I'm wrong? Is this pointless? Nobody's going to be able to see what I'm seeing, and this is too difficult to really just tease out the subtle inconsistencies and etc. But at this point, and it's partly from getting confirmation from readers and listeners, at this point, I'm feeling like I'm shooting duck in a barrel. Like it's just so obvious, the deception. So that's weird to move from one experience to the other, not quickly because it's been 3 years, but they're just so far apart. So it's kind of like, I think the Wizard of Oz comes to mind. It's too convenient. But once you see behind the curtain, once you see something that isn't what it appears to be, it seems incredibly obvious. And yet, until you had that moment of seeing. It wasn't obvious at all. It was invisible. I think, I mean, one of the things I discussed in the piece was how, what despite the fact that Supernatural has been touted as this great new breakthrough revelatory text and all the rest of it, there have been books very similar, not necessarily in style or even content, but in message, at regular intervals throughout the decades, that basically present the non-materialist paradigm and say, this is it. Right? So it's as though we're just constantly being worked on and worked on and worked on.
Okay. I also think, too, I mean, it's very clever marketing as well, you know, saying it's the most important book on the paranormal since Charles Fort's Book of the Damned. I mean, that's going to pull in readers. And I was, you know, when these sorts of books come out, you know, I'm often seduced by the marketing, I suppose, and I think, oh, I've got to read this. It's obviously a very important book, you know. So I don't know. I think you got to take that side of it into consideration as well. It's perhaps some of it's just very clever marketing as well, and it's hard to say too how readers are going to respond to the book, because it hasn't been out that long. And I know it has received a lot of glowing reviews on Amazon and so on, but I think we'd need to sort of wait a bit longer, maybe a few years.
It is a bit premature in terms of see how influential it is, but and it hasn't been reviewed by mainstream press, it seems, as yet.
Yeah.
Which would seem to give the lie to the idea that it's part of a, you know, concerted, orchestrated effort to promote Whitley. I mean, doesn't he have friends at the New York Times and et cetera?
Yeah.
I don't know. But
And also, he mentions having known Edgar Mitchell as well, which is interesting. And he passed away not long ago. He's an important figure in that whole sort of, you know, New Age movement, if you want to call it that. Do you remember that from reading the book, how he mentioned at one point through a mutual friend, I think it was, meeting Edgar Mitchell?
I certainly very familiar with Edgar Mitchell and all the rest of it, and I don't remember anything new in the Supernatural, whether he just name drops him or was there more to it than that?
I think it was mainly just sort of name dropping, but also just one other thing. What about you talk about in your book Prisoner of Infinity, Streber's missing summer of 68? Was it 1968?
Yeah,
it was in England, and Streber mentioned that in the book, and he mentioned something, because I don't have a copy of the book with me anymore, I can't actually refer to it, but he mentioned something about, so he was met this young woman, and he said that she started behaving in a way that suggested she was mentally ill, and that he went through some of her luggage or something, and he found a, what was it, like a dried outfit?
He calls it a nun's outfit this time, whereas in the initial account, it was a human costume, like a human skin with eye and everything. So that's pretty radical change in the narrative.
Wasn't there something about a dried owl, though?
The dried owl is consistent, I think, throughout. I think the first mention of the dried owl was in communion when he first mentions this hazy, fuzzy period of 68, where he starts in London and ends up in Rome, and Barcelona even, but in Rome and then he just says something about a dried owl and something so frightening that I fled, I fled Rome and never looked back, or whatever the quote is. So if we take his description at face value, then initially he just had this fragmentary memory that involved being in Italy and a dried owl. And then he later, it kind of been later, he must have just chosen not to include it in communion, because the main body of description about those experiences is on one of the hypnosis tapes, because he has a special session with Bud Hopkins present, or certainly Bud Hopkins is present, but was, I can't remember if Hopkins was doing the hypnotizing now, but anyway, where he recounts all of those experiences, those very processed church-like experiences of, well, I say processed church-like, I mean, because he was also involved with the processed church, that it just seems that they match up, but cult-like anyway, of being manipulated sexually by these shadowy figures and having sex with this woman, the same woman who he calls mentally unbalanced later on, and that he describes as living in chaste intimacy with in the supernatural, which is, as I say, that's an actual lie at that point.
Yeah.
So anyway, but... there's a big something around that. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt. Why did you zero in on that?
Oh, I just sort of thought that, you know, that seems to be the most significant thing of all, you know, was his story. I think it all kind of comes back to that period in his life. I mean, that's the period that's haziest, that he, you know, he doesn't sort of, he doesn't go into any depth at all, any detail at all.
No.
Regarding that. So, yeah, that's just one of the big holes in his story. So, yeah, it all seems to go back to that, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I just sort of thought that, it frustrates me that Strieber doesn't... he's chosen not to tell us what really happened back in that period, and... it frustrates me that I got very frustrated reading The Supernatural. The fact that he's just, he's sort of withholding information from his readers.
And yet he's over the years he's leaked these little tidbits here and there, and these clues that if follow them up as I have, they lead into this whole. Latticework or network of connections that is very suggestive, as you know. I just posted Passport to Manchuria, so it's topical in that sense, even though you would have read it a long time ago. But so, for example, that one clue about Martin Sharp, which he just mentions it in passing in Transformation because of he wants to describe another amazing confirmation that the visitors are real. So, but he does happen to mention the full name of the person he knew in London being Martin Sharp. And as you may remember from Prisoner Infinity, once I followed up Martin Sharp, it opened up all kinds of doorways into that period and what Strieber was on the edges of, if not at the center of, including very early promotion of UFO flying saucer religion stuff, congruent with Process Church. Article on Process Church, all in Oz magazine, Martin Sharp, and then the connections to Philip Morrow, who directed Communion, and so on. And so he certainly made connections back then that were more than just incidental passing, you know, more than just personal ones, like that. They seem to be very important connections in his career and in his formation as a writer, as a fiction / non-fiction writer.
Yeah. You've had some contact with Whitley Strieber, like via email and so on. You would have, have you had any luck getting information from him at all? In any kind of response? Okay. Right.
I've had the occasional curt response. It doesn't seem that there's much point, really, Lewis. I mean, it just seems too clear to me that either he's so fragmented that you never know which Whitley you're going to get, and or he's engaged in a very long-term, very clever disinformation strategy for whatever motives he might think. He might genuinely believe it's part of the visitor's plan and he's working... for some higher force, or he's just, you know, a CIA puppet and doing what he's told, but or both or neither, I don't know. But anyway, the overall, Whitley does not seem like somebody that one can just have a straightforward conversation with that will involve going into those areas that he's been, I was going to say careful to conceal, but of course he's been quite careless about it. But I had to really do the digging. I mean, when some of the most explosive or most suggestive things that I cite in Prisoner Infinity, they just go back to audios on his website. So when he was talking to Peter Lavenda, for example, he just went off about the Process Church for 5 minutes. So most of it isn't on, it's on record, but only if you really are willing to dig for it.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say Kripal did, in my opinion, did the opposite of digging with the supernatural. He, I mean, I guess there was also a choice selection material, but I mean, Strieber was selecting the material he wanted to select, and then Kripal was interpreting in the way he interpreted. But the overall effect was to reframe Strieber, as you were pointing out earlier, in this religious spiritual context, not as a human social psychological mystery to be examined and unpacked and researched and all the rest of it, but as a finished product. This is Whitley, and the book, even though it's all about asking questions and raising questions, to me it was the opposite. It was like closing down the whole debate and closing down curiosity about Whitley Strieber by turning him into this narrative, really, this distorted narrative, this very superficial, supernatural narrative.
I don't know. I mean, Kripal does say in the book too that he doesn't do conspiracies, and people always, especially academics or you know popular writers too, that they shy away from all that whole area because Well, first of all, I don't think you could necessarily even get published by one of the major publishing companies if you were to write a book about, you know, that had anything to do with conspiracies. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, why do you think it's always kind of shunned, I suppose? It's very obvious that, that there are, I mean, Whitley Strieber, he talks about, this program that he was involved in as a child, and that is kind of, conspiratorial material.
Totally, yeah.
You'd think that Kripal would be keen to investigate that, no matter what, if he really wants to get to the truth of
You would think he'd be keen to look into the implications about Esalen being used by intelligence as a front and a research institute and all the rest of it. But no, he's just like, I don't do conspiracy. Well, very convenient, no? I mean, it's really hard not to be cynical, skeptical about Kripal at this point. Even though I want to give anyone the benefit of the doubt, particularly as he's been friendly towards me, so... Anyway, there was a larger question about a conspiracy, and I did have an answer, but I've gone and forgotten what it was. I know what I was thinking, also this wasn't where I wanted to go, but in the meantime, I think what it was, that Mitch Horowitz was the editor, and he's all about, I mean, I haven't read any of his stuff, but he's all about the occult, secret history of America and stuff like that, so he can't possibly be opposed to conspiracy. I'm not sure if this is where I was going either, but there's certainly this is an example of the real, I would say, dishonesty of Kripal's arguments, is when he says that he doesn't do conspiracy, he doesn't do the whacked out conspiracy stuff, as he calls it, the more far out, the more outlandish conspiracy theories around alien contact, etc. It's entirely inconsistent, because he's willing to entertain the most outlandish interpretations possible, which is really that reality is not reality, and that an implant can just disappear and reappear because the psyche of Strieber is so powerful and profound that whatever it is, I mean, he doesn't make it credible. He doesn't make it a coherent narrative. He just sort of goes off into this woo-woo thing, which I've noticed is quite consistent in his, his arguments, I think, because it was in Authors of the Impossible and the other one, Mutants and Mystics. This idea that reality is not what we think it is, and it's not fixed, and therefore our own psyches can actually shape our reality, therefore we don't have to try and figure out what's actually going on at a physical level or talk about what's really happened, because it's all mutable anyway. Well, that's just New Age thought through and through. Entirely. Mm. And so why, if you believe that, why are conspiracy theories whacked out? Like, why is that less probable? I'm getting a bit indignant here. I don't want to be. But it's a double standard. And so then, of course, to address your question, and I mentioned this on my recent thing about organized ritual abuse, that, people's accounts, children don't describe memories of being abducted by aliens very much, as far as I know. I don't know if you've heard many accounts, but I haven't. But they're constantly testifying or claiming that they've been ritually abused. But whereas adults, they're all about alien abduction. And the alien abduction narrative is popularized, and it's now even being taken seriously by academia in the form of Jeffrey Kripal. John Mack a few decades ago was doing the same. It's generally a very popular interpretation or narrative, whatever you want to call it, as compared to the organized ritual abuse, even though there is stacks of evidence for this and confessions and all the rest of it, and yet it's still considered Looney Tunes, satanic panic, mass hysteria. So I guess, I mean, that's kind of the answer, isn't it? Is that once you start really looking at the parapolitical reality of what's going on, what these groups and agencies are up to, and the kind of, I mean, who gets implicated? Because, of course, the media is implicated. You don't have to dig very deep to get to Henry Lucci and Life magazine and the different publication houses and their affiliations, etc., etc. So it's kind of not really a surprise that, I mean, conspiracy theory is okay because that's a subculture, that's a form of entertainment now, but real, genuine inquiry into, you know, the parapolitical underlayers of our society and social engineering and that stuff, well, A, it's just not that sexy and glamorous and exciting and entertaining, unlike, you know, alien abductions, etc. And B, apparently we haven't been, whatever the process is, you know, desensitized or lobotomized enough to hear that stuff and not care, you know what I mean? Because I think a big part of it is once people are somehow so desensitized or so overwhelmed by the material that they're not going to, that they'll just take it at this surface mind level and then it can become entertainment. Yeah. But, you know, organized ritual abuse is too charged right now. I mean, Strieber, he had a whole chapter about the finders in Communion Enigma. Of course, Kripal didn't go there. And as I pointed out in my review, there was no mention of MKUltra. I mean, Strieber mentioned the program, and Kripal used it as you know, context for his traumatic secret, but that was that.
And there's some Carol Rainey. I don't know if you've read some of her material about, because she used to be married to Bud Hopkins, and she was saying that Bud Hopkins was sort of he totally believed that alien abductions were happening, and he almost he just ignored all the evidence to the contrary. So he was a little bit sort of he wasn't entirely honest, really, was the research that he was doing certainly wasn't objective. And he was an important figure in, you know, this whole alien abduction phenomenon.
He was also an artist beforehand, so...
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of back to that imaginative faculty being very important.
I was just wondering if you'd sort of looked into the... you read some of Carol Rainey's material.
I don't know if I have. I know I was definitely aware of her back with the Jacobs scandal, that whole thing, and so I looked into it for a while. But I don't know if I went as far as to read her stuff. I mean, she was somebody I would think about talking to on the podcast as well, possibly. I don't know if she does that.
No, that would be worth looking into. I just might take a bit of a little bit of a rest here. I'm doing this call center job, and just been doing it for just sort of a couple of weeks now. It's sort of you just got to sit there for 9 hours a day, trying to help people with their tax inquiries, and it's so tiring. I kind of got like a sore voice from doing that, talking a lot. Anyway,
are you talking about how you need to rest your voice then?
That's what
seemed ironic, because you took quite a while to say it. I've already been talking more than you have, so Yeah. I don't want it to be, you know, like that, because that seems like I'm a poor host.
No, not at all. I just wanted to say too, how's the second hand shop going too?
It's going very well, actually. I really heartily recommend the thrift store business to anyone, really. But I did think of you, like, because you've talked about struggling and to make a living and stuff. Mm. So if you lived in a community large enough to support that, it seems like an incredibly I won't say easy, I don't like that word, easy, but organic and natural. And it's the first time I ever felt like I was earning an honest living, I have to say, because it just feels very much like a community service that we're providing, and we're getting paid for our time, but we don't have to buy anything. It just, people just bring it in and we sell it. You know, some people bring stuff in, and then other people take the stuff out, and just keeps circulating like that, redistribution of wealth. Our job is to put it all in a nice context, make it easy for people and make it available to them, and create a space where people will be comfortable. And we are branching out as we plan to. We've got a section with crystals and tarot and a few new age books, which I love the irony of it, because there is a market for that in this small town. You know, there's pagans and Wiccans and whatnot. And so we're going to be also cornering that market, I think. And of course, it's ironic because I've been so basically down on all of that stuff in the last few years, and now I'll be selling it to people literally.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you do this 5 days a week, more or less, or Saturday as well?
It's open 5 days a week, but I work. It's a bit mixed up right now, but I probably do about two days a week, full, about almost half the time actually at the moment.
Yeah, right. And you've been enjoying it, like interacting with customers and all that kind of thing? I mean,
yeah, I have actually. It's very positive interactions. I mean, one of the things where, and this is more my wife's example that I followed, it's just selling stuff very cheap generally. I mean, unless it's something really valuable comes in, we'll price it for what it's worth, or at least higher than the other stuff. But most of the stuff, just sell it really cheap. Everything, all the clothes for $2 and stuff for $1.50, and just keep it circulating, keep it moving, but also so people don't feel they have to haggle, and there isn't that recurring tension around money, which, as you know, is universal. Like, everybody has issues around money, and everybody, if they feel like they're not getting a good deal, then they take it personally, and there's a sort of power struggle that can happen over the smallest transaction with money, right? We're avoiding that, I think, somewhat consciously, but by just being very free and loose about price. If somebody sort of makes a face when we say the price, we'll just cut it right down and say you can have it for that sort of thing, and just be, in that sense, super accommodating, right? Keep the customer satisfied.
Okay.
Well, and people respond to that. They do. They respond to being treated well and received warmly. And so, actually, there have been very positive interactions with the public.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Well, I'm happy for you there. Thanks. You know. It's a clever idea, starting a thrift shop.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't, though, because it just... somebody just offered it to us, and we're like, oh, okay. So we didn't even have the idea. We just went along with the opportunity, and neither of us had thought about it. We'd thought about loads of different things, but we hadn't thought about this. And those are generally the best decisions, I think, are the ones we don't actually even think about or work out. They're just an opportunity appears, and then you take it because it's so easy.
Yeah, and you'll be able to earn enough to pay off your mortgage and and support yourself while you do your writing too, I take it.
It's looking very good in that regard, yeah. Second part of this conversation with Lewis Proud will be online coming Wednesday, the 16th of March 2016. For more on Lewis and his books, you can go to lewisproud.net, linked in the show notes.